low comedians of the worst type, vapid songs, silly aimless tricks, in short, absolute trash. On coming out, which I did very quickly, I came to a concert hall. Here at least, I thought, I may see something worth seeing, or at any rate hear it. But no, of all the banal twaddle I think that concert was the worst. I left as quickly as I could, and seeing a picture gallery, entered it without expecting much satisfaction, and was not disappointed. All the rubbishy pictures in the world seemed to have been gathered together and hung on the walls of this ugly, pretentious building. I then returned to my guide, who had, as it were, concealed his natural brightness, and, led by him, made my way through mean streets towards the center of the town. Here I entered a very ugly brick church built in the pseudo-Gothic style. A service was being conducted by a fat, slimy sort of parson, who seemed to mouth his words in a succulent, unctuous manner which irritated me intensely. The service was not absolutely discordant or blasphemous, it was merely hollow and unreal. The prayers were gabbled off as quickly as possible, and it was obvious that there was no real belief behind it. It was merely a form carried through by priest and people because it was considered the proper thing to do. I will give you a few of the phrases which struck me in his sermon. Above all, my dear brothers and sisters, you must help to keep this great city clean of every form of vice. Each and every one of you should make it his or her business to watch for evil, to hunt it out and drive it forth. If you suspect that any person is secretly guilty of some vicious practice, do not rest till you discover his or her secret sin. Even if it is someone near and dear to you, it is your duty to denounce it. If you want help or advice in this great work, come to me and tell me what you suspect. Don't wait till the evil thing becomes rampant, strike at once. In me you will always find a ready helper. Do not let any false ideas of honor stand in your way. In searching out evil, you are entitled to use any means. Let me give you an example. A friend of yours does not come to church. You suspect her of carrying on an intrigue with someone else's husband. You should pretend to be sympathetic, you should trap her into a confession if possible. You should warn her husband, above all, you should tell me. He went on in this strain for some time, and ended up with, and when guilt is established, no mercy must be shown to the guilty members of society. They must be driven out. They must be hurled from the battlements into the great chasm from which there is no return. In conclusion, he announced there would be a social entertainment next day in order to raise funds for church improvements. As I was going out, I heard one member of the congregation say to another, "Both men, what I would like to know is what happens to all the money which he is always raising for church improvements." The other replied, "I'm sure he pockets it, or at any rate most of it." The first man, "Yes, so I think, but what does he spend it on?" The second man, "I suspect that he leads a double life, has a second home, you know." I heard no more, but I determined to go to the social entertainment. In due course I arrived there, and in a sort of church hall found the vicar and his curate surrounded by a worshipping band of females. They hung on his every word, and when they got a chance poured scandal into his ear. Between times they told spiteful tales about the vicar and various female members of his congregation. At length I got a chance of a few words with the vicar alone, and said, "Vicar, I'm going to ask you a plain question between man and man, and you can rely on my discretion. Do you believe in the truths of the Christian religion which you have to teach, or are you, like so many learned divines, personally convinced the whole thing is a myth, and if so, do you really think there is a God, heaven and hell, and so forth?" He pressed his two hands together and said unctuously, "A great deal turns on what you mean by belief. A clergyman has a great responsibility. He must not say anything which may cause a weaker brother to stumble." I pressed him closely on the point, and at length he said, "Personally I have long thought that the tale of Christ is a myth, a beautiful myth, and I am sure Saint Paul thought so. I don't think the early Christians ever thought otherwise. They regarded it as a symbol which taught a great truth, just as the ancient Egyptians preached of the death and resurrection of Osiris. I don't imagine for a moment that an educated Egyptian believed that Osiris ever really lived. It was a parable. Unfortunately, the ignorant gradually grew to regard the parable as literally true, and during the Middle Ages this belief became universal. Today we are by degrees recovering the truth and clearing away the dross of superstition, but of course we cannot proclaim these facts from the housetops. Indeed, if we did, we should probably be called agnostics, and turned out of our livings. Still, quietly, we are doing a great work, a great work. I said, if, then, the whole of Christianity is based on a parable, of what use is the church? He. Of the very greatest, my friend. It is a great moral force. That is what it was originally intended to be, and in that sphere it can be of the greatest benefit. Oh, I foresee a long life of useful work for the church when freed from all the superstitious accretions which have attached themselves to its ancient form. Many men who at present are disgusted at what they rightly regard as puerile fables will rally to it as a great social factor for the moral uplifting of the masses. I think some people are inclined to lay too much stress on its social value, and overlook the importance of its moral influence, but they are materialists, thank heaven, I am not one of them. I. Do you think there are such places as heaven and hell, and is there after all such a being as God? He. With regard to the last point, I think we are not as yet in a position to give a definite answer. We are at liberty to hold our own views. To some people the conception of a God of some sort is necessary, like the parables of Christ, or they would cease to obey the moral law, but, personally, while I would not be so presumptuous as to say there is no God, I do not consider one is essential. I consider that this world is governed by laws, and the moral law is the highest. Those who break the moral law sooner or later are punished by that law, so that I do not see that an arbitrary creator is necessary. But, of course, I should not say this to my flock as a whole. I interrupted the flow of eloquence with, still, it is not necessary to conceive of God as an arbitrary autocrat. He may be a wise, all-seeing judge, who coordinates his various laws. He may be, but to turn to the question of heaven and hell, I think I may say frankly I don't believe in either. I consider that each man, roughly speaking, gets his rewards and punishments on this earth either by disease or from his fellow men. Hell I consider a monstrous idea. For my part one should hesitate of course to say there is no life after death, but I doubt it. I stared at him for a minute, and then said, but how did you get here? He. In rather a curious way. I was very ill, and at length became unconscious. While I was in this state I had some most curious and horrible dreams. I won't trouble to describe them, but then I was evidently delirious. When I recovered I found myself here, without my wife. No one could tell me exactly how I came here, but being here, and finding that the vicar of this church had just disappeared in a most mysterious way, I took up his cure, and have done his work ever since. Everybody is agreed that he must be dead. That's the curious thing about life here. People don't die. I never have a funeral service. They just vanish. I can't help thinking the sanitary authorities dispose of the bodies silently, but, after all, I've other things to bother about. My parish is a fashionable one, in the best part of the city, and I have to devote my whole time to it. I. But you've married again? He. Yes. I soon came to the conclusion that while I was ill, my wife must have died, so I had no hesitation in marrying again. Of course I'm too old to need that sort of thing. But my wife is a great help in the parish, a great help. I'm afraid she is not always tactful, but one can't have everything. I. Then even you do not realize that you are in hell? He. What a preposterous question. I then proceeded to give my reasons for knowing we were in hell, and narrated my adventures since I died. He listened very coldly, and at last broke in with, thank you. I've heard enough. If I were a swearing man I should use strong language, but as it is, I will content myself with saying that I don't believe a word you've told me. I'm sorry I have wasted my time talking to such a man. If you are not a liar, then, by your own showing, you are an unmitigated scoundrel. Good day, and I should advise you to leave this city as soon as possible, for although I shall not myself denounce you, being a humane man, Others will certainly discover your true character, and then you can expect little mercy. He left me, and a moment later began to tell two women who hurried up to him all about me, so I thought it best to depart without undue delay. Goodbye. I close. H. J. L. Chapter 33, A Debate in Hell as to Whether There is a Life After Death. Transvision, September 7, 1914. As soon as I reached the house in which H. J. L. lived, I found the officer waiting, and he at once continued his story. After wandering through the city for some time, I saw a building which appeared to be a sort of institute. On looking in, I perceived that there was a kind of debate in progress. It appeared that some missionaries from the higher realms had been holding meetings, and as a result someone had proposed the theme, "Is there a life after death?" One man said, "There is no evidence that men live after death. Some people I know argue that we have died, and therefore since we are now alive this fact proves that there is a life after death. But this is begging the question. We are alive, and therefore this proves that we have not died. We have all been very ill, and on recovering find the whole earth changed. Look, how grey the sky is, and how dark it is all day." "Yes," broke in another man, "that's why I'm sure we are dead, and I believe we are in hell." "Preposterous," cried the first speaker. "We are just as comfortable here as we were before our illness. I don't believe in hell, but if, for the sake of argument, we admit that there may be such a place, all will agree that this cannot be hell. The parsons taught us that hell is a place of eternal torment, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched. Well, there is nothing of that sort here. We are of course all rather bored with the same endless round of petty cares and troubles, but that is what we always find on earth. There is no anguish of the damned any more than we experience the imaginary joys of heaven. That, to my mind, is one of the strongest proofs possible that we are not dead. If there were such a thing as life after death, it would be entirely different to life on earth. Now this life may differ from life when we were younger, but it is not so entirely different as it would be if we were disembodied spirits. Gentlemen, I move that this house considers that there is no convincing evidence in favor of life after death. I will not detain you with the arguments of his opponent, who maintained that there was life after death. They followed the usual lines which might be expected. The speaker declared that he was sure he had died, and so on. He admitted that he was puzzled where they were, but considered that they were probably in purgatory. Indignant protests from several staunch Protestants, who declared this was popish rot. The chairman intervened, and order was restored. I felt, however, he only half believed his own arguments. The next man who rose had a really ingenious theory, though it failed to convince many of the audience. He said, "I know I died, and this life I believe is just a dream. I suppose our brains go on working for some little time after life is declared extinct. Having lost all real control of the body, it spends its time weaving wonderful dreams. Of course I know this cannot last long, but when on earth, I have often dreamed long dreams, in which days and weeks seemed to elapse, and found out afterwards that I had not dozed for more than 5 minutes. You will say at once, then we are merely the phantoms of our brains. You are right. There is no city, no debating hall, no one but myself. I have dreamed you all. Soon my brain will run down, and then the dream will cease. Look how we go on doing exactly the same things as we did on earth over and over again like automatons. No, the only life after death consists of the dreams of a dying brain, but I waste my time talking to the creations of my own fancy." And he sat down with a morose frown. A roar of laughter greeted this speech. Then I sprang up. "Gentlemen, I am but a stranger who has wandered into your city on his journey to another place, but if you will only believe me, I think I can convince you that there is a life after death, and whether or not there is heaven, there is certainly hell, and we are in it. Further, there are lower depths of hell than this, and in them men suffer torments akin to those which are considered proper to hell. Listen to my own adventures since I died." But it was no use. Before I had nearly finished they shouted me down, and several threatened to haul me off to the battlements. As I went out, a man followed me, and as soon as I had got out of sight of the building, he came up to me and said, "Sir, I know you are right, and as you have worked your way up through so many divisions of hell, you will doubtless escape in the end. May I come with you?" Before I could answer, his guide became visible, and said, "My son, I will guide you out of this realm to a place where loving friends will help you. Come, follow me." It was impossible for any to help you till you desired help, but now I may return to you. And they went away together. Chapter 34, He reaches the seventh division. So I journeyed on alone, led by my own guide out of that city. We passed other cities and villages all very much alike, till at length we reached a high mountain range. Slowly and painfully up this we climbed, and the higher we went the harder and steeper became the path, till at length we reached the top, and saw a short way in front another rest house, larger and finer than any I had seen before. High up towered the building, and from the topmost story a great light beamed forth into the darkness. But the powers of darkness were not going to allow me to escape without one last effort, and suddenly I was surrounded by a howling mob, which tried to drag me back and cast me over the cliff. But I had not toiled so hard and suffered so much to lose heart now, and summoning all my willpower to me, I hurled my assailants to right and left. Even as I did so, my guide stood beside me in all his brightness, and the vile spirits fell back screaming with fear. To me the pain was intense, but I bore it, and stumbling forward fell against the door. Instantly it opened, and kind hands drew me in and the door slammed to. As it did so I heard a yell of baffled rage and hate. Then I heard my guardian angel's voice saying, "Son, for a while you will not see me, but I shall be always at hand." The strangers whom I could not see because of the light led me away into a darkened room. I shall not describe all that happened there. You know already from what J. H. L. has told you. For some time I stayed in the hospital undergoing treatment, which was directed to drawing out of my spiritual form all the gross and evil matter it contained. When this work was completed, I had shrunk to the size of a tiny baby. Then they began to build up my frame, and after a short while I was able to take my place in the schools. Here I met P, who showed me the greatest kindness, and though I was one of the worst boys in the school, never ceased trying to help me. When he left the school, he particularly urged me to try and follow him, and I determined to do so. But that must wait till Saturday, for it is time you returned. So though I, J. W., was loath to leave them, I departed. Chapter 35, He escapes out of hell at last. Automatic letter, Sept 12, 1914. The officer will take control and complete his narrative. H. J. L. The officer. When it was time for me to leave the school, I must admit that a great dread filled me. I feared the terrible darkness almost more than anything else, but I refused to give way to this feeling, and asked to be shown the way. Now we are not permitted to go out of hell by the road by which H. J. L. visited and returned from the schools in hell. We have to climb the sides of the precipice, and very hard it is. We went out of the same door by which I had entered the rest house, and turning to the right passed along a broad ledge. One side was the chasm which led down to the sixth division, while on our right hand was a high cliff. The darkness seemed blacker than ever, probably because I had begun to get used to light in the schools. We were passing a cave when a huge and hideous form sprang out, crying, "Hold, none may escape from hell." But ere he had time to touch me, my guide turned and made the sign of the cross in the direction of the foul creature, who screamed and fled back into his stinking den. The next phase will ever remain in my memory as a hideous nightmare. We began to climb the almost precipitous cliff. I kept constantly slipping back. Stones and rubbish slid from beneath my feet, but still on we climbed. My guide appeared to float slowly upwards, always a little ahead, and from him the light flowed which lit up my path. At length he bade me stay, and I did so thankfully. We had reached a small level platform, and here he bandaged my eyes, saying, "To your weak faith, even the dim light of half-belief will be for a time too strong." So we continued the upward journey, but at length came to a piece up which I simply could not climb. My guide said, "Fear not, I will help you to surmount this last obstacle, for the end of your long journey is almost attained." Next moment I felt his hand in mine, and making a last effort scrambled out onto the level top of the cliff. It seemed to be in a blaze of light, like the plains in India at midday. In spite of the bandage, the pain was so intense that I rolled on the ground in anguish. The rest of the story you know, how P. was there to greet me and introduce me to H. J. L., and how from him I have learnt how to communicate through you with the earth. Now this task is finished, and I am going with a band of other spirits to work on the astral plane. There I hope to help many of the soldiers who are laying down their lives for their country. My knowledge is considerable, both of the astral plane and of hell, and I hope to be able to guide and save many. Among them perhaps I may still find a few of my old comrades in arms. P. has gone back to work in hell, and the monk has passed on beyond this realm through the great wall of fire. Now farewell all. The officer. I close. H. J. L. Part 3, W. A. The Astral Plane, Chapter 1, W. A. Passes Over, Letter from W. A. April 11, 1914. I find it difficult to start, but she'll do better in a moment. I am W. A. You know the rest. When death came upon me I seemed to lose consciousness for a moment, and then I suddenly felt much freer and better. I cried out, "I'm better, M." Then I was aware of a terrible darkness all around me. I could see nothing, and hear nothing. "What is it? Is this the beginning of death?" I inquired. I passed my hands over my body, and was thankful to find I had a body and could feel it. Then dimly in the far distance I perceived a faint speck of light. It grew brighter, and seemed to be approaching me. Suddenly close by me I was aware of a greater intensity of darkness, and then a sensation of something horrible and evil became evident. I trembled and seemed filled with nausea, and turned towards the distant speck of light. But though I could now see what it really was, I was unable to approach it. What I saw was a great and glorious spirit of light, but so far distant that I could form no clear idea of his features and relative size. "Am I dead?" I shrieked, and an evil voice at my shoulder cried, "Yes, but fear not. I will look after you, protect you, and guide you." I shrank from this awful being, nevertheless, and turning to the bright spirit tried to approach him, but could not. Then I tried to find my way out of the room, for I conceived myself still to be in it, but found I could move no great distance from what I ultimately discovered was my body. Now to make matters plain to you I should say that I was really in my astral body, but of course did not know it at the time. Further, having done little on earth to develop my spiritual faculties, I was at first as one who is blind. After a while I began to be faintly aware of someone weeping. I knew instinctively it was M, and sought her that I might comfort her, but alas, I could not even see her. After what seemed like an endless age I began to see things dimly, like a man looking through a dirty glass, and the things I saw appeared blurred and indistinct. In time, let me tell you, we astrals are able to perceive you mortals as clearly as you can each other, yet when we reach the state of the spiritual body we see your bodies much less distinctly, but your souls and your thoughts much more plainly. Gradually I became conscious of the fact that I was watching some persons place something in a box, and in time realized it was my coffin. Then I was aware of traveling in a vague, dreamlike way, of crossing land and water and land. Suddenly I perceived that I was in familiar surroundings. It was P. Then a vague sensation of my funeral, and then, clear and distinct at last, I saw the coffin being lowered into the grave. I followed the mourners back to my house, and by degrees I began to understand more clearly the conditions under which I now lived. The first thing that I realized was that I, who had always considered myself a businessman, had failed those I loved best in the very point I should have been most businesslike about. I was present while men whom I had believed to be my friends devised means by which they might take advantage of my carelessness in drawing up my will. I had left my dear ones at their mercy, and mercy they would get none. Oh, how I suffered, and yet even then I realized the justice of my punishment. I had often taken advantage of another man's carelessness to snatch a mean advantage. I called it good business then, now I saw it in its true light. I drifted away, for I found, strive as I would, I could do nothing to influence these harpies, and so fled away dejected and the miserable. Suddenly I heard a voice strangely familiar to me, and I saw D. Y. W. Dear, how glad I am to meet you! She cried. I can't say how glad I was to meet at length someone with whom I had been in contact in life. It's quite like old times, I cried, only, alas, we have no bodies. Don't worry about that, we can manage that, she replied. Come with me, dear. We went along hand in hand, and presently we found ourselves in a room. In it were a man and a woman. Watch me, she cried. In some strange way she appeared to attach herself to the woman. The effect was magical. She had appeared pale, wan and shadowy, but now before me she grew young, handsome and healthy. She seemed also to become more and more material. Splendid, I cried, how do you do it? I suck up the vital energy from this fool and convert it to my own use. You do likewise with that man. Then in a large measure we shall be as we were of old. But doesn't it hurt the woman? Of course, it drains away her vitality, and in time will kill her. But what of that? My God, no! I cried, I will never do such a thing. I may have been a blackguard, but I'll never do that. Get away, you wretch. Don't be so silly, dear, she began, but I was filled with a sudden sense of loathing. She turned like a fiend on me and shrieked, you shall pay for this. I'll bring someone who will make you suffer for it. Do so, I cried, and left her. Now I will stop for the time being. W. A. Chapter 2, How Old Friends Behaved on Learning of His Death. Trance Conversation, April 13th. I felt myself whirling through space, and then found myself in H. J. L.S. room. He greeted me with evident pleasure, and then added, W. A. will be here in a moment, and I think he had better continue the narrative he began in the letter. The next moment W. A. entered, and almost at once began. After leaving D., I wandered about feeling lost and forsaken. Presently I thought of a former friend, and immediately I was standing in a breakfast room in a large house. The place was quite familiar to me. A man and woman were seated at breakfast, and the former spoke. I've just heard that W. A. is dead, died very suddenly, and I. W. A. watched her closely. She turned slightly pale, then said, poor fellow. He was rather a pal of yours, wasn't he? I expect you'll miss him. Yes, I shall, he was a decent sort. Of course, he had his faults, as we all have, but he was a man. A few minutes later she slipped out of the room, and I followed her. She entered her bedroom, and I expected to see her throw herself on the bed in a paroxysm of grief, for we had been on the most ultimate terms, you understand me? I nodded. She did nothing of the sort, but going to a desk opened it. From it she took two packets of letters and my photo. One packet contained my letters to her, the other her letters to me. What a blessing I got him to give me back those letters, she murmured. It was only last time, too, he brought them. The next lover I have I'll take damned good care I write nothing compromising. If these had been in his possession when he died, I should have never known when I was safe. She went to the empty fireplace and carefully burnt first my letters, then hers. Finally she took my photo in her hands. Anxiously I hung near her, hoping for some sign of grief, or at least regret. So, W., you've gone. We have had many jolly days together. I shall have to find someone else to teach me golf now. Yes, I had better burn it. What's the good of being sentimental? If I kept it, it might lead to awkward suspicions if discovered. She pushed the photo into the dying flames, and in a minute it was consumed. She went to her jewel box, and taking out a bracelet looked at it. Is she going to destroy that too? I thought, and remembered that it had cost me £20. I began to read her thoughts, and they were these, can I safely keep it, or would it be wise to sell it? If I do the latter, I don't suppose I shall get a third of its value. It's a beauty. I saw one very like it marked £25 only the day before yesterday.